good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. I'm Joe Donahue. I hope you had a lovely Thanksgiving holiday or a whatever you celebrate. I don't know. Well, it was Black Friday. It was Thanksgiving, Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, and then
and Football Sunday.
Football Sunday, and then today's Cyber Monday, and then tomorrow's Giving Tuesday. So it's a lot to keep track of. It really is. So
our lives are being run by marketers.
I know.
Is what I'm hearing you
I
say.
Know. Well, that how true? How true, Robert? I must say it is. But you know what? Hopefully, you had a lovely, beautiful Thanksgiving, and I hope you did. And if you did, congratulations. You pulled it out. Good for you. And my favorite line in the movie, Broadcast News, with Albert Brooks and William Hurt.
And Holly Hunter.
And Holly Hunter. But in this scene, it's Albert Brooks and William Hurt, James L. Brooks production. And William Hurt says, "What do you do when your life supersedes reality?" And Albert Brooks says, "You keep it to yourself."
That's a great line.
Otherwise, there might be some men with white coats coming for you.
You keep it to yourself. All right, so we'll get going here. Let me introduce everybody. Joseph Palamountain, Chair in Government at Skidmore College. Bo Breslin is in the house. Good morning, Bo. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm well, and lots of fun conversation before we started, but apparently it's Robert's birthday, so happy birthday, Robert.
Thank you, Bo.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Just don't ask me how old I am.
Well, you told us, but we won't tell.
You're only young once, but you can be immature forever.
You know, I've noticed that.
Have you?
Yes.
Well, you know.
Yes, I have.
Well, thank you, Bo. Congratulations, Robert. Happy birthday to you.
Thanks, man.
Senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. How does one celebrate?
Well, I'm in my Buffalo Bills hat today because that's how I celebrated.
That was a good game.
It's Victory Monday, baby. Any day when the Bills win is the morning after, the sun shines a little bit brighter. So that was a pretty good birthday present.
You know, the first half of that game, you were like, boy, here we go. Because he got sacked like eight times last game, and you're like, no, this isn't going to go well. And then that he's a machine. That Josh Allen's just a machine. Mm-hmm. And he turned it on, and my God, he was running all over the place, and it was just a joy to watch.
Okay, but now I'm gonna, you know, sound like a Bills fan because, you know, remember we went to four Super Bowls and lost them all. So this is Charlie Brown the football. I've seen this movie before. I know how it ends.
But in that moment, after a long holiday weekend, it was just something to rejoice.
Yeah. And so it's a good win.
It's a lovely birthday gift for
one game at a time.
One Super Bowl before I die, which, you know, is now.
You're getting closer, my friend. You're getting closer.
Exactly right.
New England Patriots play tonight, play the New York Giants. And
oh, God.
Yeah, it should be a close one. Yeah. But those are the teams that, like, typically in old fashioned, in the olden days when they were the dynasty of the New England Patriots, those are the kind of games they used to lose.
Two Super Bowls against the Giants.
Here we go. Anyway, Libby Post is with us and is a political consultant, is a lobbyist, is our dear friend. Good morning. How are you? How is everything?
Everything is good. I know that it's Robert's birthday, so happy birthday. But
thank you, Libby.
The other thing is that today is World AIDS Day, and this administration has decided that nothing in the federal government will actually recognize World AIDS Day or the people who have died from AIDS, or the people who are still living with AIDS, which there's a lot of them now. And so we just can't forget what happened. And, you know, I was somebody who lived through it with some dear friends. And so we just, you know, what this administration is trying to do is whitewash our history in so many ways. And this is one of those ways. And the thing is this, we're not going to forget.
Yeah, so. And let's, in addition to that, Libby, well said, in addition to that, 70 years ago today, Rosa Parks refused to give up the seat in Montgomery. So
there
let's
you go.
See how the how the country and the administration handles this moment.
Am I wrong to say that suddenly, and I guess because I spend so much time in the news business, we've suddenly gotten a little bit forgetful? I was surprised that there was no coverage, for example, on the anniversary of the Kennedy assassination this year.
Yeah.
I didn't hear a word.
Yeah, it was
about
very
it.
Quiet.
Very little.
Very quiet.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
So it's like we're memory-holing a lot of key events in American history.
That's right.
One of the things, too, that I would just like to mention, I was going to bring up World AIDS Day, but there is the fact that the White House will not be commemorating it, and the United States is not formally commemorating it, which is awful. However, it seems more awful is the fact that the money that was going into the research, that was actually the federal funding cuts to go to the programs that were committed to this global epidemic went away.
USAID.
Right. Yeah. So I just think, yes, this is awful that they're not doing this, and that is horrible. And yet the real money going on the ground to help people
And again, this administration doesn't care if people of color die, especially those ones who live in that horrible continent. I mean, you know, this I can't say what he calls it on the air, but because Joe would have to hit the button. But, you know, they don't they just don't care if people die. And we're seeing it happening. We're seeing it happen here when kids are dying of measles. But we're seeing AIDS once again ravaging some African countries. And we have the ability to make a difference, and we're not.
1.2 million people living with HIV in the United States. Overall, roughly 1.3 million people newly infected in just 2024, and 40 million people worldwide. So we're not talking small numbers by any stretch of the imagination. All right, let's go to other topics and start the morning off. A lot of things, you know, it's tough. It's been 4 days since we've done a show, so a lot's happened. So we have to kind of make good on some of the things, and then we'll move on here. I do want to get to the National Guard attack, which happened on Wednesday night. So this is before the holiday, Wednesday afternoon, I should say, in Washington, D.C. And this dominated much of the coverage over the weekend. The article that I will read to start us off on this is from the Washington Post. Karen Tumulty is the author. She writes, there was a time not that far in the past when a shocking tragedy would bring the country together. Americans had the capacity to grieve as one, as they did, for instance, in the aftermath of the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks. This reflected their sense of a common purpose and a shared value, whatever their political differences might be. So far, almost the opposite is happening after two young National Guard members from West Virginia were ambushed, killing one, leaving the other in critical condition. It occurred on the eve of Thanksgiving and just a block away from the White House, against a national backdrop of rising political violence and deep polarization. What has sent President Donald Trump into a fury is the fact that the suspected gunman is an Afghan national allowed entry to the United States in 2021 after his service with the CIA during America's 20-year war in his country. I will tell you that as I saw that news alert pop up on my phone, I thought, oh, dear God, here we go. Buckle up. This attack underscores the greatest national security threat facing our nation, Trump said in a video Wednesday night. At a time that calls for moving the country forward, Trump remains transfixed and finding ways to blame his predecessor for what has happened on his watch. His comment went on, the last administration let in 20 million unknown and unvetted foreigners from all over the world, from places that you don't even want to know about. No country can tolerate such a risk to our very survival. While Trump officials were quick to level criticisms of the previous administration for granting the suspect and his family entry to the U.S. in 2021, they brushed aside any examination of the administration's role in granting asylum to the shooter earlier this year. Meanwhile, crucial questions have yet to be answered. Did ideological motives or mental illness send this 29-year-old on a road trip across the country to allegedly carry out the attack? Were warning signs missed in the extensive vetting that preceded his entry into this country? And how can something so similar be prevented in the future? Even without solid evidence, the president has stepped up his screeds against immigrants and fallen back on divisive actions that fit his longstanding predilections. He vowed to permanently pause migration from all third world countries. He also oddly went after some Somali refugees.
Mm-hmm.
And in starkly derogatory and sweeping terms, he said some of whom have been implicated in a massive unfolding fraud scheme in Minnesota. He was asked what this had to do with what happened in Washington and the Afghan National, and he said, because Somalians have caused a lot of trouble, end quote. So that is my brief wrap up with the words from the Washington Post. Who would like to go first? Birthday boy.
Oh, thank you, Joe. this is a tough one for me for reasons. My office is in D.C. I spend a lot of time down there. I've made it a point ever since the National Guard started patrolling the metro stations to always, you know, say good morning, make eye contact and whatnot. And in fact, the subway or the metro station where this occurred nearby is the one that I go to. Yeah. So, I mean, I cannot help but wonder, did I see these kids? And frankly, they look like kids.
Oh, they do.
And I don't say that dismissively. I mean, it's actually kind of heartwarming because given the political situation in D.C., you almost can just see them light up when you just acknowledge them. And then they remind me of my former students. And also, I know Karen. I used to work with Karen Tumulty at Time Magazine. She was one of our Washington correspondents, and a very good one. And honestly, I kind of liked her a lot more as a correspondent than as an opinion writer, for reasons I won't go into. But look, this whole story is obviously a bit of a Rorschach test, right? In other words, this president, one office on a strong anti-immigrant platform. So, and we know he's a rageaholic. So none of this really surprises me. But I mean, I'm sorry to disappoint our listeners. I'm just not ready to talk about this yet as anything other than a human tragedy. I mean, I cannot stop thinking about those two young people, one of whom is dead and one of whom is, you know, clinging to life. There will be time to dissect the vetting, how rigorous it was, etc. But right now, my thoughts and prayers are with those two.
I agree with you entirely. 20 years old is the age of deceased,
so
which is very, very young and just heartbreaking. I mean, heartbreaking no matter what their age, but so young. But also, I would agree with you up to the point where. And then you look at it and you say, oh, and by the way, we're going to send 500 more mm-hmm. of these kids mm-hmm. to yeah. Washington, D.C. And I think,
That's where it becomes a bit of a Rorschach test, right? In other words, if you are opposed to this measure, then that upsets you. And look, you know, since I spent so much time in D.C., candidly, if you talk to folks down there, left or right, vocally on the right, but even my colleagues on the left will acknowledge, yeah, you know, it does. The city does feel a little bit safer now. They're not going to say that out loud, but you know, this is not going to go away. And you know, also the National Guard. The one thing I will say, Joe, and maybe this is a vain hope, but it would be nice if we stopped talking about things like, you know, oh, the National Guard and ICE or Trump's Gestapo. We don't know the motivations of this shooter. The Afghans, for what it's worth, are a very sympathetic group, right? I mean, these were our allies that we brought into this country, after having left that country after how many years were we there? 17 years or some such. So this is an unfortunate circumstance, no matter how you slice it. But back to the matter at hand, does Trump's response to this surprise me? No, it would surprise me if he didn't respond this way.
Bo.
Yeah, and I think that I'll pick up right where Robert left off. He and I might disagree with a couple of things, but Joe, I found it interesting that you said buckle up. That is to say, this is Trump playbook. It's just working out in front of our faces. Trump's approach is to turn a tragedy, and I'll pause here to honor the National Guard's persons who were shot. But his approach is to turn a tragedy into an anti-immigrant rallying cry for his base. Think about the list is long. Jose Garcia Zarate, 5 times deported, accused of murdering Katie Stanley on a San Francisco pier. What's interesting is that Garcia Zarate did not get convicted of that. He faced a trial, and the trial suggested that he was not guilty. But you also have Laken Riley, Jocelyn Nergani, Rachel Moran, Marilyn Ferris. These are all people who were assaulted or killed by folks from other countries, and Trump sees it as an opportunity to go big. And so over 315 times while in office, the president has remarked that the murder of Americans by foreign people of color is grounds to make sweeping policy changes. 315 times, right? Undocumented persons are far less likely to commit or engage in crime than domestic Americans. That is a statistical fact. And yet, the Trump administration spends a lot of time, and Trump himself spends a lot of time leveraging what are very, high-profile press moments, and all a tragedy. I get it, but they're high-profile press moments in which to make sweeping changes. So think about what his sweeping changes are. One, he's now paused all asylum petitions. Two, he's going to start investigating those who already have asylum in this country. Three, he's targeting Afghans, right? So there's no reason to suggest that Afghans are any more likely or less likely to engage in crime. Four, Afghanistan is now again one of those 19 countries that I'll call a Muslim ban, even if the press won't call a Muslim ban, in an attempt to sort of keep particular folks out. I have more to say, but I'm going to pass it to Libby because I think there are a couple of tropes here that I would like to come back to, Joe, but I'll pass to Libby now.
All right.
Okay. Why, thank you.
I just could keep going on
for
and on.
Your,
nobody
for
wants
your
that.
Pre-trope comments,
right?
Please,
right.
Go on.
So, what kind of trope is it going to be? A Torah portion trope, or is it just going to be a regular old trope?
Regular old trope. But
okay.
I'll get back to that.
Yeah. Right. Let me know if you want to learn the other stuff. I can hook you up. I can hook you up. I can't do it, but I can hook you up. So here we are talking about all this, and all Trump is doing is scapegoating people to get people's attention away from the really shiny object in the room, which is the Epstein files and the what can ultimately undo this presidency. How about this? Here's a headline in the Times from today.
Yes.
College student is deported during trip home for Thanksgiving. Annie Lucia Lopez Beloza, 19, was detained by immigration agents at the Boston airport before a flight to surprise her family in Texas for Thanksgiving. She's now in Honduras. No one can find where she is, right? These women who get put into these situations are, ripe for sexual violence. Nobody's paying attention, right? A 19-year-old college student, somebody who's here as she should be. They say, oh, there was an order to deport her back in like 2000 and something when she was a child. I mean, she's 19. So it's like this administration will do whatever it needs to do to demonize the other in order to take focus away from the issues that the people in the United States. If you don't want to talk about Epstein, let's talk about affordability. Let's talk about health care.
Well, that's right? what I was getting at. All I was going to say is that we have Epstein or not.
This would,
this would be the same playbook that Trump would. I don't think it has anything to do with that.
Joe, can I point out we're doing it ourselves, okay? I mean, there's a reason I said this is a Rorschach test, because we're taking the death of a National Guards person and
it's a butterfly giving birth to a goat.
And okay, but now we're turning it into a referendum on all these other things.
Yes.
So,
well, this is a referendum. This is a referendum on who we are as a people.
Okay, but
and
just
whether or not
choose.
We
either
want...
we're going to talk about the story, or we're going to talk about the things that the story gives us permission to discuss.
I'm not sure what you mean, because... Okay. We are here discussing this story and discussing all the other issues.
But we weren't discussing a college student being deported, for example.
No, we were talking about how he is going after the other around immigration. Okay? And here's a prime example of a woman, 19 years old, who's doing really well in school. He's afraid, Trump, that she's going to, when she graduates, she's going to take the job of somebody who isn't qualified to take the job she might get. I mean, this is what we're up against here. We're constantly demonizing the other, demonizing people of color. It adds to the political violence that we're already living through, which is just totally unacceptable. And we now have a 19-year-old woman in Honduras, in a country that she doesn't know, and her parents and her lawyer can't get a hold of her. And this is endemic of the way this administration sees people of color, sees immigrants. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter if you're an Afghan. It doesn't matter if you're Hispanic. It doesn't matter, you know, as long as your skin is dark and you've got a vowel at the end of your name, we're coming for you.
And I think Robert, you were right when you said Trump ran and was successful in the campaign on a very vigorous and fierce anti-immigration. It wasn't the only thing he stood on, but it was a very successful political message that he got across. And what I think Libby is simply saying is he's spinning that in part because I think it's a winning message for his base. And as a result, we're seeing college students who are deported and anti-Afghan rhetoric and the types of things that I think are problematic. What I was going to say, Joe, if I have a few moments here on these tropes, what's interesting is, and I hope, Robert, this is part of the story, is the pot shots at Somalis that you mentioned included two things that caught my attention, not because I'm a moderate Democrat and I'm trying to avoid being woke, but he said two things that I thought were super interesting. One is that this whole group, including Somalis, are, quote, non-compatible with Western civilization, right? Mm-hmm. As if Western civilization is the top of the heap and somehow everybody else, people of color, is the message, are not compatible with Western civilization. Two, he refers continually to third world countries, right? So those two, and again, not for woke reasons, those two terms are old-fashioned tropes that are anti somehow everybody else but white Americans are somehow less, are inferior, and so on. I'm not telling him he needs to change his language, but let's be clear about the fact that that plays to the base who sits around and thinks, yeah, those people, those Somalis, are non-compatible with Western civilization, European American whiteness, and a third world country. You know, that to me is deeply problematic.
Did you hear, I don't have it in front of me, Bo, but there was something I heard on NPR this morning. One of the administration officials, maybe it was Christine Noem, I'm not sure who it was, saying that they wanted to make sure that asylum seekers, I don't remember the exact phrase, were capable of assimilation.
Yes, that was on Meet the Press with Krista Volker. Yeah,
which I found fascinating. Yeah. I mean, look, my name ends in a vowel, Libby. I'm a grandchild of immigrants, but I've told this story a lot. My grandparents spoke fluent Italian, but made it never in front of me. In other words, the ethos in my family is if we wanted to speak Italian, we'd have stayed in the old country. We came here to be Americans. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the dog that's not barking here. Mm-hmm. If you want to ascribe nefarious motives and say it's all about keeping people of color out, et cetera, I'm not sure I agree with that. But I do think that we have lost something. I hope this is not a controversial thing to say. In abandoning the melting pot metaphor in this country. I mean, yes, we are a nation of immigrants, but we're also an immigrant, a nation of assimilated immigrants. No. And I worry what happens when we abandon that ethos.
No, the melting pot is what I grew up with. And,
yeah,
and
sure
it was a positive. And I still think it's a positive.
Amen.
Because it lets everybody add to the flavor in that pot of who the United States is, right? And so I have no problem with that. You know, it's just that this administration doesn't want a melting pot. They just want white, just white sugar.
It's not my job to defend this administration,
well,
Libby,
so,
but I'm not sure I agree with that.
And I might be the one, I might be the odd man out here, but the melting pot, you know, I'm 59. I'm close to you, Robert. Not quite.
You're not going to catch up
at 59. The melting pot was the mantra in which we grew up in.
And we
I mean,
know
the
why
reality
you
is how many right? remember Schoolhouse Rock, where they literally had a melting pot.
I do.
Literally
yeah.
sing
right?
that song.
And
yeah.
So
how
a bill becomes a law.
How yeah. right? But we, what has happened over the last half of my life has been a move away from the idea that the melting pot is the ideal, because the melting pot, okay, call me woke, the melting pot reflects a white, paternalistic, sometimes misogynistic America. Now, I love America, don't get me wrong, but I love America as a tossed salad, where everybody we're still in the salad bowl together. But at the end of the day, the tomatoes are different than the lettuce and the croutons, and that's what makes America great. I always go, last thing I'll say, Joe, I always go back to the founding, and the greatness of America is liberty and the freedom with which to chart your own path, not enter into a melting pot as a particular
yeah, that's
flavor.
That's a very good description of why the melting pot as a metaphor fell into disfavor, disabuse, et cetera. But do you not agree that we are seeing issues, particularly in Europe right now, with significant number of refugees or immigrants not assimilating?
Yes.
So in other words, if this is a pendulum, we got to figure out a way to honor difference. And let's be yes. also honest, you know, one of the reasons the melting pot fell into disfavor is because some groups were simply not allowed to melt, right?
Right.
They were kept out. So I'm not naive about this.
But
there is a cultural price to pay when you have what you're calling the salad bowl, what right. Mayor Dinkins back in the day used to call the gorgeous mosaic. Surely there's a middle ground here.
Yeah, and I think where you and I would fall on the same page, Robert, is the idea that it is complex to
yeah.
figure out
Amen.
What is the balance. Because I want those people who come to America, I want them to understand the values and principles of America,
well
right?
Said.
I certainly don't want somebody to come here just to
yeah, we can't
to
be
diss
Balkanized.
On.
We yeah, cannot be a Balkanized
I won the birth lottery by being born in the United States. I will absolutely
here, here.
Agree to that. That said, you can't give up your identity however you define it.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that people are, that the Trump administration is asking people to give up their identity is ethnically give it up to mm-hmm. become pure Americans. Christine Noem said that. That is not what America should be standing for. So it's some complicated balance, Robert, between the way in which the Trump administration sees it and perhaps the way in which I see it.
But to bring it full circle to back to this, the conversation where we started to have, I think this is an important conversation, and I don't think it is furthered by demonizing one side or the other, by demonizing immigrants, by assuming that the political motivations here are purely nefarious. This is an issue that is not going to go away. We're going to have to wrestle with this earnestly.
Except that this administration is demonizing the immigrants. Okay, so
what part was I unclear about? Right, we can't do either one.
Right, maybe. I get it. But you also just can't deny the reality of what this administration is
doing. Which I did not.
And they are demonizing immigrants. Yes, they want everybody to be white and male and straight.
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
But, you know, we have, you know, I was lucky. I'm a second generation Jew from New York, right? I know the privilege that I have because my skin is white and my parents were born here and I was, you know. But I also know what it was like from the stories I heard from my grandmother, who was really the only grandparent that I knew, you know, about what it was like in the shtetl and what it was like being persecuted as a Jew in white Russia. Actually, it was Ukraine where they were from, in a little town I'm sure that no longer exists. But, you know, we have to recognize that we all have something to bring to the table here. And when some of the immigrants, I mean, somebody said before that they don't want to assimilate, it's because we make it really hard for people to assimilate. The notion that immigrants are the other permeates everything that we do. And it permeates our speech, it permeates our politic, and it makes it really, really difficult to say to the Afghans who are here, right, who, by the way, the Jewish community helped resettle. Because we all gave furniture. We did a lot of stuff out of my synagogue and the other synagogues. But when they are constantly looked at as the other and not brought in any way, it's really difficult for them. And I can understand it.
Can I really point out, by the way, just playing fact checker here, if the Trump administration wants everybody to be white, he's failing his own test. Three of his cabinet members are people of color.
Yes. Well, yes. However, 90%, yes. I looked it up too, Robert, 90% of the, it's the least diverse White House in the history
of White
Houses.
Well,
I mean, probably back in the Jefferson time, there weren't that many.
Right.
But certainly since the 20th century.
So. Yeah. And you got to look at who these people are.
Yeah.
Clarence Thomas, he might be black. But his politics are certainly echoing the racism of the Trump administration.
Oh my.
Okay? You have to look at who these people are and where they came from and what, you know, there's those two women, I can't remember what their names are, but two relatively young women of color who are like Trump acolytes and are constantly, you know, going out there and talking about things. And I'm just like, you know, you can do that because maybe you were raised with a silver spoon in your mouth. Maybe you didn't have to deal with challenges growing up. But let's be honest. This is a racist administration, three out of how many ever, constantly looking at people of color as the other and really just making life more difficult. Cutting the programs. Getting rid of the Department of Education could very well be one of the single most heinous things that this administration can do in terms of funding for programs for underprivileged kids.
I do think we can be more nuanced, though, as opposed to painting with such a broad brush of they hate everyone. And I think there are enough examples that we can point to. We have to take a break, which I'm sad about because I could have listened to Bo's salad analogy for another hour because he didn't even get to bacon bits.
Or dressings.
No dressings. He didn't mention croutons. I'm in, man. We'll take a break and we will return. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us, and we welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We got quite a few letters, so I would like to read a few of those before our top of the hour break. Tommy says, I think that the melting pot meme was an oversimplification. We are more like a chunky, savory, delicious stew.
Okay. I like that, too.
With a bit of grizzle mixed in.
Chunky and style.
Every once in a while, you have to watch for the bones. Tommy thought that through.
He did. Bravo, good. Tommy.
We say, hello, panelists. When I was a teaching assistant at a SUNY grad school in the 90s, I was required to take a touchy-feely class in which the professor told us the melting pot was wrong and that we should refer to it as a salad bowl. Mm-hmm. I was also taught we couldn't grade papers with red ink because that color would be too intimidating
to the students.
Yes. Sometimes well-meaning people can take an idea and run with it just a little too far.
Oh, thank you.
Every generation that came to American melting pot retained cultural practices and beliefs while contributing to a rich, spicy soup.
Let's get that person on the panel.
All right.
So if you can't mark your papers in red.
Oh, this is
I've never heard that.
Don't get me started on this.
From the black or blue pen that
this is a thing in educational practice. Story for another time, but no, this the letter writer is correct. I remember
them talking about that. Also, there was the whole white chalk, yellow chalk. Do you remember that?
No, because I am not that old. We had whiteboards and overhead projectors, Joe.
Oh, do tell the story.
No, in teaching, but I mean in growing up, because we're all basically the same age. Okay. But on the blackboard. We had this transition from white chalk to yellow chalk because it was easier on our our eyes, and it was more soothing than the starkness of black and white.
Black and yellow as a color combination is very effective. As somebody who does this for a living, so it's very effective to have those two colors together.
Maybe it was just a Wissahickon thing. I don't know.
Wow. The suburbs of Philly.
Yes. As someone who is old enough to remember Kent State, I was never in favor of sending National Guard troops to American cities. The risk for injury or death to National Guard members and civilians is just too great. Sending troops to police American cities is not their mission. Then Oliver checks in, placing the National Guard on the streets of our cities as sitting ducks was going to invite violence of some sort, just as what tragically transpired in D.C. last week. Thing is, almost no matter who took a shot at the National Guard would present themselves as targets for retribution. If the shooter had been a young person representing whatever passes for the left, then Trump would be sicking his minions on so-called Antifa. Right now, that from Oliver. Then we go to John, who says, "Hey Robert, who are you trying to gaslight?"
Is that one in all caps?
I didn't know. I'm not going to tell you. Do you remember when Trump and Vance were accusing Haitians in Ohio of cannibalism?
Eating dogs and cats, I think, is what it was.
I don't think it was cannibalism.
Not
cannibalism. Unless you're talking cat. Then we go to Rocky. Let's not pussyfoot around. Trump is a straight-out racist, calling Mexicans criminals and murderers, to saying there are some good white supremacists. There is no reason that the Proud Boys and Oath Givers love him. Keepers, I believe, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. David Duke says that Trump is the first president he can support in his life. That is from Rocky.
And that's a ringing endorsement.
Then we go to Chris. Assimilate. Did any of our European forebears come to America with the goal of assimilating? Did the British assimilate in India, South Africa, Australia, writes Chris.
Well, I think, if you want to see some assimilation, you should watch the movie Hester Street with Carol Kane from the 80s, I think it was. And it showed the stark realities of Jewish immigrants coming to America and assimilating and not assimilating. It was one of the. It was a great movie.
And I would also mention, I have my wrist slapped by the writer who said, maybe I'm a little bit too progressive in my thinking about the salad. But folks came to America in the beginning largely because of religious persecution. Mm-hmm. And there was no sense that they should somehow become something different religiously. That's why they came to the United States. Mm-hmm. So back to just to put a stamp on it, back to what Robert said, you know, it's hard. It's a hard, complex thing to figure out what part of America should be assimilated and what part of Americans should stay distinct.
But historically, it's kind of sorted itself out, right? In other words, this is what, and again, I don't want to beat the point to death, but when we honor the melting pot as a national metaphor, it sends a cultural signal that, sure, keep your religion, keep your traditions, but you are expected to fit in, right?
Yes, but
when you discredit it, you're sending a very different signal.
Well, true, but it's also that's where it gets complicated, because the melting pot itself suggests that, you know, you're both contributing to the soup.
Yeah.
But you're losing your identity because it becomes a soup.
Yeah.
That's the problem. That's why I think, shame on me, with that writer, that's why I think the salad metaphor is a better metaphor, because you don't mm-hmm. lose your identity, but you're part of a salad.
Yeah. We're all in the same bowl.
Oh, my God. Did you honestly, Joe, think that we would be talking about salads and soups?
Well, it's so close to Thanksgiving.
Only in a few hours, yeah, so you know how it is.
All right. Ruth says the not-so-subtle messages from this Republican administration are clear and simple. One, black and brown people in countries are by definition a threat to white people and countries. Mm-hmm. Two, people from non-European countries by definition are not capable of becoming real Americans. And three, violent crimes committed by black and brown people and immigrants are by definition more horrific than those, like school shootings, committed by white men, and are proof of number one and number two. That from Ruth. We go to Matt. This unfortunate attack, for which the individual responsible should be held fully responsible, is also the result of our culture, not Afghan culture or some other form of foreign scourge. We train this person to be a killer. In response, here in occupied D.C., 500 more National Guard troops are being rolled out, and each cohort of guard, 2 to 3 to sometimes more individual soldiers patrolling, will be accompanied by a D.C. Metro police officer. The Republican Congress and Trump have already held back $1 billion of local tax money since the spring continuing resolution. This is a waste of money, a waste of space, and only invites more agitation, whether expressed in a just way or not. That from Matt.
You know what's interesting, Joe?
Yes.
I heard this morning on Morning Edition, I think the number was 190,000 Afghans have been granted some level of asylum since the Biden administration shut down the Afghanistan war and had that, what was a chaotic departure. 190,000 is
that
a
does,
lot.
It is, and for what it's worth, that does give me pause about the degree of vetting. In other words, you're claiming they were all, not you, but I've heard over and over, they were all extensively vetting. How could you extensively vet 190,000 people?
That's, so
that's a huge number.
The wonderful guest they had on Morning Edition was a professor at Arizona State. He said a decent number of that 190,000 made their way through largely Qatar and other places and had months and months of vetting. So he was pretty, now he's on the left, he was pretty confident that that they weren't just, as Trump suggests, throwing folks on a plane and having them arrive in Newark.
Yeah.
Right? There was a decent amount of vetting. He seemed to be pretty comfortable with it. It does seem like a lot of people to get through the system.
Sure does.
And this guy was granted asylum by this administration. Yeah. So let's not forget that.
Yeah.
Deborah writes, while it remains unclear why this young man was motivated to do this horrible thing, I also wonder if anyone is questioning the wisdom of the National Guard being there in the first place. Mm-hmm. My heart aches for the families of all
Mine too.
And then Vincent, I agree with Libby. The student is the same age as my daughter, who is a student in Boston. Every day the Trump administration stokes the flames of hatred and fear and violence, and then wonders why the country is going off the rails. The National Guard members are the victims of this, along with all of the rest of us.
That's the interesting thing, though, Joe. Sorry to keep commenting. I'm not sure the Trump administration believes the country's going off the rails, right? And the wonders whether or not the country's going off the rails. This is part of a political strategy that is, for all intents and purposes, working pretty well for them.
For them, yes. It's the 2025. It's Project 2025 from the Heritage Foundation.
Ultimately,
we'll see how well it works in some of these special elections that are coming up.
Tennessee,
and then how it's going to work with the redistricting, which I know we're probably going to talk about, but also the midterms next year. It's not going to be a cakewalk. We saw what happened in New York, where in upstate New York, the Democrats had a very good showing. They actually came out to vote. Onondaga, the Dems took over the county ledge for the first time in 50 years. In the 5th Judicial District, which is Jefferson, Lewis, Herkimer, Oswego, Onondaga, Oneida, three Democrats won for Supreme Court. I ran one of those campaigns, and it was like unheard of. Absolutely unheard of.
One more letter, and then we'll take a break. Michael says, melting pot, salad, soup, you know, they're all great when not seasoned with hate.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
True. We'll end there. Da-dum-da. We go over to David Gesina in news and a break. We will be back in just a moment right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion on this Monday, the 1st of December, the last month of calendar year 2025.
It's amazing how quickly it's gone.
Right?
yes and no. Yes. There are certain aspects of it, yes. And then I was looking at some pictures in my camera roll the other day, and I said, oh, my God, that was February. It seems like it was 9 years ago.
Yeah.
But yes, you're right. Generally, it has gone very quickly, and here we are, and we only have a month left before we dive deep into 2026. But here we go on our second story this morning. A top Republican and Democrats in Congress suggested on Sunday that American military officials might have committed a war crime in President Trump's offensive against boats in the Caribbean after a news report said that during one such attack, a follow-up strike was ordered to kill survivors. This reporting is from the New York Times. My apologies. Michael Gold at the New York Times. The remarks came in response to a Washington Post report on Friday that said Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth had given a verbal order to kill everyone on a board boat suspected of smuggling drugs, and that this led a military commander to carry out a second strike to kill those who had initially survived an attack in early September. Obviously, if that occurred, that would be very serious, and I agree that that would be an illegal act, said Representative Mike Turner, Republican of Ohio, and a former chairman of the Intelligence Committee, said on Face the Nation on CBS. Senator Tim Kaine, a Democrat of Virginia, said on CBS that if the report was accurate, the attack rises to the level of a war crime. And on CNN, when asked if he believed a second strike to kill survivors constituted a war crime, Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, answered, "It seems so." The lawmaker's comments came after top Republicans and Democrats on two congressional committees overseeing the Pentagon vowed over the weekend to increase their scrutiny of U.S. boat strikes in the Caribbean after the report. Mr. Turner said the article had only sharpened lawmakers' already grave questions about the operation. Boat.
Joe, I was interested in, you know, I've been following the story, obviously, as we all have been, but the press didn't dig deeply on this as to why it's a war crime. And so I did a little digging. It's not that hard to find, but I wondered, how is this considered a war crime? And there are five different requirements, all of which seem to be in place here. So I'll quickly go through them. One, all five of these have to be in place for it to be considered a war crime. One, no declared war in the Caribbean. So that raises the possibility of a war crime. Two, individuals are considered civilians, and the murder of civilians is only considered justified when there's, quote, an imminent threat to life. And there doesn't seem to be an imminent threat to life with these people, with these folks on the boats in the Caribbean. Three, this is considered an extrajudicial execution in that the American government is executing these folks without any judicial process. Four, it's a violation of what's called, and this is new. Well, this was new to me, the no quarter rule. The kill them all that Hegseth said is directed toward those who cannot fight back, a helpless individual. There's no ability for the folks on the boats to fight back. So that no quarter rule is also in play. And five, this one seems a little less important, but the wanton destruction of property is not justified by military necessity is also considered a war crime. All five of those seem to be in place, and those are the definitions, according to the United Nations, of what constitutes a war crime. The press is not doing a great job of, in my opinion, of describing that. Maybe it just takes up too much space. But that's the reason why we're here, not just because he's haphazardly throwing bombs at boats.
We should say all of this is alleged, right? We weren't there. We don't know. Sure. But if the report is accurate, then yes, those criteria appear to have been met. I had a completely different response, Bo. I mean, having lamented on the roundtable in the past that Congress has been MIA functionally, not just under this administration, but for several administrations, how refreshing is it to see Congress stepping up and recognizing its own status as a co-equal branch of government and saying, no, we're going to investigate this. We haven't heard a lot of that in recent decades.
Republicans and Democrats.
That's right. That's a good civic, that's a good act of civic hygiene.
Right. Well, I think it's because some Republicans are finding their backbone and are saying enough is enough. What they did was a war crime, and people who have been in the military are saying that. And so, you know, I think the five things or whatever it was that you, however many it was that you talked about were really elucidating. We would love for the media to be that kind of educational resource. Mm-hmm. However, you know, print media is under siege. You have Fox, who doesn't understand what international law is. And then the other networks that are honestly, some of them, I think, are now a little afraid to go up against the administration because of the threats to take away the FCC licensing and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, these folks, when this is all over and done with and they're no longer in office, may very well face a war crimes tribunal at The Hague. We'll see.
So now I'm going to put on, I totally agree, now I'm going to put on my cynical hat, Joe, and isn't it true, I think you just read that Senator Kaine from Virginia was one of the people calling for, okay, so let's put a couple of puzzle pieces together and throw it out for the group to discuss. One, Senator Kaine has pretty serious ambitions, especially when he was Hillary's running mate. Mm-hmm. Two, this is an opportunity for a senator of the stature of Kaine, a moderate Democratic senator from the stature of Kaine, to be able to stake some sort of flag on a particular issue and raise his profile. Three, last week, was it not true, Joe, that last week there was a story in the New York Times about how there's this group of Fight Club Democrats, and right. Kaine is one of those Fight Club Democrats?
Right. Like mostly anti-Schumer, right?
Mostly anti-Schumer, who are sort of pitching themselves as an alternative to the leadership, the Kirsten Gillibrand and Chuck Schumer. Kaine, I think, this is my cynical side, is seeing this as a political opportunity for him to maybe enter the 2028 race, as this is a particular, because he's seeing himself, as we were talking about during the break, he's seeing himself trailing the Mark Kellys and the J.B. Pritzkers of the world. I think Kane sees this as an opportunity to move.
We also can't forget he's a senator from Virginia,
right,
which is a heavily military state.
Right.
Right? The Navy, the Norfolk, all of that. So, you know, and then everybody from the Pentagon living in Northern Virginia. So we can't forget that either, that that's part of this, and that, you know, he wants the United States to be the United States we expect it to be, not the banana republic it's turning into.
And I, my only point is not necessarily about Kane, is that, and this is my cynical point, is that people are looking for, you know, the election for 2028 has started. And folks are trying to figure out a way in which they can separate themselves, especially on the Democratic side. Hmm. And it is very possible that Kane sees this as an opportunity that he can run with for a little while.
No, I'm not disagreeing. You're bursting my bubble. Here I was feeling good about, you know, both Republicans and Democrats stepping up and exercising oversight, and now you've dragged us back down to rank punditry and cynical political machinations.
So sorry.
Thanks very, very much, Bo.
It's my birthday gift to you.
and to the listeners.
And to the listeners, that's right. We all get to celebrate together. Isn't that a lovely thing? All right, any more on this? Hearing none, we move on and go to our next topic of conversation. We welcome your letters, as always, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Okay, so we go to, Libby, this has got you written all over it. Time is running out in the fight for over congressional maps. Actually, two stories here that have kind of merged into one. But there is what's going on in Texas of the fight there, and also just the overall as the partisan battles rage and courts wrangle proposals. The relentless pace of the calendar will force states to act or land in murky legal ground. This is a New York Times story from a trio of reporters. The nationwide redistricting arms race is growing increasingly unpredictable. Courts are knocking down maps. Republicans are breaking with President Trump. Democrats are finding new states where they will try to pick up seats. But there is one constant that will soon define the final contours of the redistricting battle, and that is the calendar. Mm. States have clear filing deadlines for candidates to get on the ballot for primary elections. Legislatures have the ability to change both these deadlines and the dates of the primaries. Many did in 2020 during the coronavirus pandemic. If state legislators decide that the highly partisan route of a mid-decade gerrymander, instead of waiting for the regular assessment that happens every 10 years, they would probably be more than willing to also pass a law moving the dates and deadlines before a planned redistricting session. But once these deadlines have passed, they are very difficult to undo. There is little known modern precedent for a legislature to throw out already cast votes in a primary election because an opportunity to draw a more partisan map has arisen. And creating a new filing deadline for candidates could cause significant confusion, invite litigation, and overburden already overworked and underfunded election officials. Libby.
Well, I'm waiting for Donald Trump to say on December 31st, we're stopping the calendar from clicking over into 2026. Right? I think that's what he would like to have happen. You know, the calendar is the calendar. I mean, in New York State, petitioning begins at the end of February. The petitions are due at the beginning of April. The primaries will be the last Tuesday in June, and then Election Day is Election Day in November. And all of this really is, from my perspective, while it's not necessarily illegal, it's underhanded and a way of gaming the system to benefit the Republicans, where it just undermines our democracy. If we can, you know, I joked before about a banana republic, but if we can change the dates of willy-nilly and decide, oh, we're going to redistrict when it's out of the time frame when you usually do that, which is after the census, then what else can we do, right? And so, you know, these calendars are put together for a reason so that elections can be held in a somewhat manageable, educated way so that people can actually vote. I mean, we have the threat to the Voting Rights Act that the Supreme Court's going to be dealing with. We have laws in various states saying, oh, well, if people are online, they can't bring a chair, right? You can't give people water if they're waiting online. You know, all these kinds of things to undermine the credibility of the of our electoral system, plus the, oh, mail ballots are bad. Well, I don't know. People have been voting absentee ballot for a very, very long time. There's never been any documented case of real fraud with absentee ballots. There's hardly ever election fraud. I've been doing a lot of elections. I mean, look, I cut my teeth in Albany County. You know, if you're going to look at what things used to be like under the old Democratic machine, you know, but that's not the way things are anymore. You had Reifenberger, right? Was in Georgia, wasn't he?
Ratzenberger.
Yeah, from Georgia.
Ratzenberger, yeah.
You know, the
Find me 11, right?
Find me some votes. Yeah. Find me some votes. I'm like, that's not the way this works. People walk into a booth, they fill in the little circles. You bring it to the machine, and it goes.
Oh, it's both. It's Raffensperger.
Raffensperger? Okay.
Raffensperger.
Yeah, Ratzenberger is the guy who played on Cheers.
I was wondering why I knew that.
I'm a font of worthless information.
There you go.
Don't sell yourself short.
Right. So, you know, I mean, we just, what they're trying to do is, as far as I'm concerned, illegal, because they're really trying to skew the electoral process to guarantee them a win. And that's not the way this is supposed to work. Period. End of story. You do a campaign, you have a message, you're either going to persuade people or you're not. We were all sort of blown away that in 2016 that Trump was able to persuade people and nobody wanted to talk to the pollsters and tell them what they were really thinking. Okay? I mean, it's about the message and it's about getting your people out to vote. We've seen this year in local elections, more Democrats coming out to vote. They don't necessarily come out to vote in local elections, but they did this year, and it's having an impact where, you know, all over the country, Republican seats flipped. People, and what this is the NOPs, the people who are not registered in a party, which is a big chunk of the electorate, are saying, this isn't what I signed up for. When they voted for Trump, they signed up for Trump 2016, which was a little bit of incompetence and foolhardiness. They didn't. They're not showing. They didn't sign up for Project 2025, and their neighbors being shipped out and their businesses being destroyed because of all these immigration raids. And that's the other part of this that nobody's talking about is that how the president's, I don't even want to call him that, how Trump's immigration policies are affecting small business. Yeah. And he's a business guy. You'd think he'd understand economics, basic economics. You need workers. You need people to come and pick the fruit in the summer so that, you know, food can get on to a plate. I mean, there's all of these things happening. And Mr. Businessman, who can cut the best deal in the world, doesn't seem to understand that.
I think I've lost the plot. We're talking about redistricting, right?
Yeah, but it's okay. All connected.
Bo, you invoked and brought us back down to earth talking about the cynicism of senators. It's funny, in my time on the roundtable, I have tried to resist the temptation, the siren song of cynicism. But man, when it comes to redistricting, it's almost impossible to not view it cynically, right? So these ongoing redistricting fights and the inevitable cascade of court battles they produce can only reinforce Americans' cynicism about politics. when maps are drawn and redrawn mid-decade, then challenged and redrawn again, it no longer looks like fair representation. It looks like a power grab. Yeah. There's just no two ways about it. And neither party has their hands clean on this. But it is just one of those things that all you need to do is look at the map and think, wait a minute, look at this district. Mm-hmm. They're called gerrymanders for a reason, right? I don't see a way out of it. I'll defer to you on that one, Bo.
I know a way out.
Okay. Well, no, but the point I was going to make is that even the reddest states have what, 1/3, 40% Democratic voters, and the opposite, the bluest of states have a significant portion of right leaning voters as well. So these are those. This is the kind of thing that just makes ordinary people, normies, as it were, just throw up their hands and think this is insane.
Yeah. So many things to say about this. I absolutely agree. Robert and Libby, both of you are right when you say, ultimately this seems like a ridiculously purely political moment when it comes and pock on both houses, right? So gerrymandering, redistricting should happen at the census moments only, not in this midstream. That said,
I knew there was a butt coming.
Yeah, so of course. I can't defend.
It's a talk show, Robert.
I can't
keep this gravy train going. For God's sakes.
I can't defend it in any way. So it's not that kind of butt. But let's talk about a couple of things.
However,
one is the rise of, and maybe I'm naive. The rise of partisanship in this country over the last, say, I'm going to say 20 years, maybe Bush versus Gore. So we'll say 25 mm-hmm. years. The rise of partisanship in a way that I think is problematic. This gerrymandering is a pure political grab in the same way that Harry Reid, as a Democrat in 2012, did a pure political grab with the quote-unquote nuclear option for mm-hmm. court appointments, right? Remember, mm-hmm. he eliminated the filibuster for lower court appointments because he couldn't get through the Republican, he couldn't get the appointments through. So that was a political grab, too. Then Mitch McConnell mm-hmm. does it for Supreme Court justices. Mm-hmm. Pure political grab. The answer to the gerrymander, and I group those together because they're entirely based on partisanship. Mm-hmm. Republicanism, being a GOP member is greater than being an American. Being a Democrat is greater than being an American. The gerrymandering thing is actually fairly easy to figure out. That is, there is a solution. It's nonpartisan commissions mm-hmm. that redraw the districts. And they're going to look like salamanders, like gerrymandering mm-hmm. is. But at the end of the day, states do a decent job of nonpartisan commissions make a constitutional amendment that says we're going to have nonpartisan commissions that are in charge of state redistricting. The last thing I'll say on this, if I have a moment, Joe, is...
Actually, can you hold?
Of course.
All right. Hold that moment. It'll be yours when we return.
Yeah, we promise.
Bo's moment right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday, the 1st of December. Bo Breslin is here, Joseph Palamountain, Jr., Chair in Government at Skidmore College. Robert Pendicio joins us, Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and was born on this day with an asterisk. And
maybe.
Ask him about it. We don't have time.
And political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post joins us as well. We welcome you all to the discussion. Before we went to break, we were talking about this issue of elections and Bo, you had one more point that you wanted to make, so I said hold on to that thought.
Right, and I just want to jump on what Libby was talking about with the Supreme Court decision, which I think has fallen a bit under the radar. Remember, this is this term that they heard oral argument in Louisiana versus Calais, where the lower court in Louisiana did some redistricting itself by adding another black district. And the Supreme Court seems quite skeptical about that move and race-based redistricting, which goes back to Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act in the 60s. That's a huge deal. If the Supreme Court says to Louisiana that there's no that Article 2 of the Voting Rights Act is no longer constitutional, that opens the floodgates for the type of, quote, pack and crack redistricting that happens often in the South, where you're packing people in and you're cracking particular neighborhoods so that largely you can call it partisan gerrymandering, but it's largely at least aligned with race-based gerrymandering. Mm-hmm. If the Supreme Court opens its door to that, we have a whole different ballgame, and I suspect the Supreme Court will strike down that particular piece of
law. Well, I think most redistricting these days is race-based.
Am I correct in assuming, Bo, that you are not persuaded by the argument some have made that the Voting Rights Act has kind of outlived its shelf life?
I'm not persuaded, Robert. I mean, I take those seriously, those arguments seriously. I'm not persuaded given the, and I've talked about this on the roundtable a lot, given that, quite frankly, race is the biggest divisive and complex issue America faces at the moment. We can talk about affordability all we want, but race is our great stain, and race is the topic that we have an inability to really come to grips with or reckon with, and so. To me, it hasn't outlived its
So, at the risk of diverting us, sorry, Joe, if I could do your job for a minute, what would be the proof point for you to say we no longer need to consider race-based redistricting?
Oh, I think I think that's it's a great question, Robert. I just don't know if I could ever imagine a country in which the political forces were such. And the terrain was fair enough, the landscape was fair enough that you wouldn't have to have congressional legislation. Remember, the Voting Rights Act is congressional legislation that acknowledges the existence of unfair and unjust practices that lead to the types of things that Libby's talking about with voting.
I need to give it more thought, honestly. Yeah. I don't want to go off half-cocked, but I mean, clearly it's not 1964 anymore. But I don't know the answer to my own question.
It's what would be the proof? 1964 in a lot of ways. It is close to 1964 in a lot of racial ways.
Yep.
All right, let's move on in the time we have allotted, and I would like to go to. I'd like to go to Marco Rubio talking about work remaining on Ukraine. We spent some time last week, an abbreviated week for us, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, but we did spend time talking about the quote-unquote deal and how close we were to a deal in regarding peace in Ukraine and a deal with Russia and how that was working out. So, after the days that have taken place since we last spoke, Secretary of State Marco Rubio emerged from talks with the Ukrainian officials in Florida on Sunday to say there was still, quote, much work to do, end quote, on a proposal to end the war in Russia. Missing from the Ukrainian group was Andriy? I believe so. Yermak, President Volodymyr Zelensky's right-hand man and chief of staff, who resigned on Friday amid a corruption investigation. Mr. Yermak has served as lead negotiator in recent talks with American officials. Neither Mr. Rubio nor the man who did lead the Ukrainian delegation after Mr. Yermak's resignation revealed details of the discussions, although both described the talks as productive. Steve Witkoff, a special envoy for President Trump, plans to arrive to Moscow on Monday to meet with, that's today, to meet with President Putin, according to a U.S. official. Mr. Zelensky said on Sunday evening that he had received a preliminary report from the delegation in Florida, saying it is important that the talks have a constructive dynamic and that all issues were discussed openly and with a clear focus on ensuring Ukraine's sovereignty and national interests. That reporting from the New York Times.
Joe, when I was last on the roundtable last week, I mentioned just kind of in passing that that corruption would dog the Ukrainian side of the negotiation. I think what's interesting is that Zelensky's right hand man resigning on Friday was in large part a really powerful signal that Zelensky and the Ukrainians really are in it to get an outcome, to get a particular negotiated peace. Here's the problem. The problem is, in some ways, the complexity, the religious and cultural complexity of Israel and Gaza was slightly easier to come up with a negotiation than this one is. For one reason only, and that is in Israel and with regard to Israel and the Palestinians, there was at least some degree of incentive for both sides to come to some conclusion. I'm not convinced that Putin sees any negotiation or any compromise or any peace plan as in Russia's best interest. Mm. So if you only have one part, I mean, it's the easiest thing in diplomacy. If you only have one party willing to sort of negotiate and compromise, then you don't have an outcome that's going to be good. I think in the Ukrainian situation, you have the same issues where Witkoff and Jared Kushner and others are talking to the Russians, talking to Putin. They put together the 28-point plan, which, as I said last time, was probably just a starting point. I get it, with some movement. But the sticking points, the ones that Ukraine is sort of unwilling to bend on, are the ones that Putin wants the most. And those are territorial loss in Ukraine. Ukraine says no. NATO possibility. Ukraine wants it. Russia doesn't. Guaranteed security. That's something that doesn't often appear these days in the press. Ukraine wants security guarantees that Russia isn't just going to turn around after this and rush right back into Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Putin is not going to give the security guarantee in the same way that Zelensky's not going to give up on NATO membership down the road. So these sticking points suggest to me that it is a little bit intractable. And then finally, because Putin has no real incentive— the Trump administration is not imposing the level of sanctions that would make it really tough on them. Oil is still flowing. They don't seem to care about the millions of Russians who are losing their lives on the front lines. You know, Putin wants to be the strong guy. I just don't see Putin moving at all. So I think we're in the same situation a week, a month, a year from now.
What a depressing thing to say.
Sorry about that.
No, it's fascinating. I'm wholly out of my depth on this, so I'm eager to learn from those who are better informed than I am. So Bo, I'm doing it again, Joe. I'm doing your job. What is the best interest of America at this point? If you're advising Rubio, if you're advising Witkoff, it sounds like the way you're— if I'm reading you correctly, it sounds like they're going to come away with nothing here.
Well, I think that, I mean, the best interest of the U.S. is always to have peace overseas.
Sure.
And especially, remember, now I'm going to come at this from an Obama administration, not from a Trump administration. I just have no idea.
Yeah.
You know, our greatest ally is Europe.
Yeah.
And the Europeans want peace on their doorstep for all sorts of economic, social, cultural, immigration, you know, political, geopolitical, diplomacy reasons. So the U.S. under the Obama administration would have been much more supportive of Europe's position on this than the Trump administration is. That said, America's best interest is not to have the fight.
Is exhaustion no part of the calculus at this point? I mean, this has been going on for how many years now?
So exhaustion on whose part?
On the part of both the combatants, Ukraine and Russia.
Yeah, so I mentioned last time, and I'll mention him again, a fantastic thinker on this, a fantastic writer on this is a guy named Paul Hockenis, who writes that the Ukrainians, the people, we're talking about the people, they might be exhausted, but they are resigned to, and they are, but they are resigned to the fact that this is a fight worth fighting.
Okay.
And so as we enter the last month, I know you're telling me to
no, you're all right.
As we enter the last month before 2026, the semi-quincentennial of the American Revolution, 250th anniversary, one thing that made the Americans beat the much more powerful British was that our resolve was deeper. The Ukrainians have that. So the question is whether or not, I don't think exhaustion is the key.
All right, I'm going to let Bob do my job one more time and say, and say this.
We'll be back after this short break.
There you go. Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And here we go. We have just a few moments and time for one more topic, I believe. And but we have.
I just want to make one statement.
I'm sorry. Did I not get you on the? I apologize, Libby.
Right. My one statement is Vladimir Putin's perspective on this. Is what's mine is mine, and what's yours is mine.
Right. So
that's all. I'm done.
So what do we do with that, though?
Well, the United States isn't going to do anything to...
changing, arguably.
No. But and this administration is not going to do anything to really help the Ukrainians. That's pretty obvious. I mean, yeah, we'll give them munitions and all that sort of stuff. But Trump isn't, like, telling Putin, you know, knock it off. He's not using the strength of our country and what it means to be a democracy to really, really pressure him into doing something. His people are not happy. Putin's people aren't happy, but their economy is in free fall. But yet the oligarchs are doing quite well.
Yeah. And
sort of like here.
And the fact of the matter is we could. This is what's interesting is, Libby, we could step up our game.
Yeah.
With regard to, as you describe, as munitions, give them the Tomahawk missiles that they need. Make sure that there's a constant flow of weapons that go into Ukraine. Always remember that Ukraine is moving towards a completely liberal democratic state behind the Iron Curtain not that long ago. That's who we should be in bed with.
All right. One more topic in the 7 minutes that we have left, and we go to Pope Leo. And I thought this was interesting and significant. Mm-hmm. But Pope Leo is making his way throughout the world, and it's the first foreign trip. And the article in the Washington Post talks about Pope Leo being the quiet pope, and also that this trip is revealing his style. In the largest event of his inaugural foreign trip, Prince, take two, Pope Leo spoke to a few thousand faithful in this Muslim-majority metropolis on Saturday in Istanbul. Of unity, of breaking down the walls of prejudice, of rejecting darkness in favor of light. But it wasn't just what the new pope said, it was how he said it. It was a small mass by the standard of papal travel. He didn't preach loudly or gesticulate. He spoke in a calm, easy tone of a neighborhood parish priest. To hear Pope Leo, he makes you lean in. His predecessor, Pope Francis, could be meandering off the cuff. Leo stays on script. Francis was blessed with or suffered from, depending on whom you asked, an excess of personality. Leo is low-key. Francis was given to gestures that made headlines, washing the feet of drug addicts, praying with an imam at Istanbul's famed Sultan Ahmed Mosque. Leo, much less so. He surveyed the vast structure known as the Blue Mosque with a legion of cameras trained on him. But when invited to pray in front of onlooking journalists, Leo, according to a mosque officials who accompanied him, politely declined. On his first international trip, the understated persona of a new pope is emerging. The 70-year-old from Chicago's South Side is positioning himself as an antidote to an era of towering egos. As he wrapped up 3.5 days in Turkey before moving to Lebanon on Sunday, in his speeches and actions, he emphasized the opposite of self-aggrandizement. At the Vatican, he has celebrated Mass before tens of thousands, but on his trip, he is talking about the importance of littleness. I like that.
Yeah. This is not the response that you may expect, but I like this story, Joe, and I'll confess a bias. I simply like when our prestige media treat religion seriously, which sounds like an anodyne thing to say, but it's not. It's refreshing when major media cover a religious reader without condescension, without caricature. Okay, in fairness, this piece drifted a little bit into personality journalism, but it's you know, too often mainstream outlets treat faith as either, you know, an eccentric personal hobby or a political liability. For billions of people around the world, religion is not marginal. It's central to their identity, to their moral reasoning, to their purpose. So bravo that we're seeing serious coverage of this pope.
One wonders, though, if that would be, it's, would that be separate from the Catholic Church, though, I wonder?
Say more.
Sure show. I think, I just wonder that if it wasn't the papacy, if it wasn't the grandness of that, that it would be treated with such... With the way that this story was treated.
I guess I should give the backstory. Back in the day, I worked on a prospectus for a magazine that never launched called Faith, and its entire point was going to be a serious news magazine that covered religion as news. And I remember the prospectus we wrote just documented time after time of mainstream prestige media covering religion as kind of, frankly, a freak show. So it always does my heart well to see religion treated as the serious topic it is.
Taken. Okay.
Yeah, and let me just double down, not on the press side, but on the optics side of what Pope Leo did here. Istanbul is obviously a calculated choice for the first major international trip, and a fascinating choice because of the fact that it was formerly Constantinople. Mm-hmm. It was, in fact, you know, historically the most important city, and largely the split in the Roman Catholic versus Greek Orthodox Church.
And by the way, a Turkish national shot Pope
right.
John Paul.
And all true. I understand he tried to get in the thing, and the Turkish folks said no. But the being at the intersection of the Catholic Church, being at the literal intersection of two continents, avoiding this was a super interesting part of the story for me. Pope Leo decided not to go to Hagia Sophia, right? The more famous of the mosques, in part because it was formerly a Catholic church, and he didn't want to draw attention away, so he goes to the Blue Mosque, which, if you've been to Istanbul, like I've been to, absolutely beautiful place. He goes to the Blue Mosque as a show of support for the Muslim community, right, instead of the traditional Catholic community. And there's a decent number, 30% of Turkish folks are Catholic. So for me, and then the last thing I'll say before we pass it on is I also think it is super serious when Pope Leo decides he's going to go to Lebanon after Istanbul, as opposed to, say, Jerusalem or something like that.
The person who issues the call to prayer at the mosque invited Leo to pray. He said, "I offered him, if you like to worship, you can worship here. There are journalists training their cameras on you. It is a photo-worthy moment." And he said, "No, I'm good just looking around." I love that.
He's also, so humility comes naturally to this pope because he is a White Sox fan.
And he did take off his shoes when he went into the Blue Mosque.
Chicago. Yes, Libby.
Well, this is a subject I know so much about.
Oh, Libby, tell us about your thoughts on Catholicism.
Yeah, no, you don't want to know that. I mean, he seems to be He seems to be in some ways a continuation of Pope Francis in terms of his politics, but with a different personality. And I mean, he has said that the LGBT community is welcome in the church, whether they're never going to change all their other stuff. But at least he's saying that that those folks who are Catholic in the community and still want to be accepted by the church can be, to some degree, they're welcome there. You know, I think the fact that he's from the south side of Chicago is great, and that he's like sort of not this bombast, but, you know, thoughtful, measured, and not in it for the ego is really lovely. And we'll see how things go. We'll see what happens in Lebanon. We'll see if he goes to Israel. We'll see if where else he ends up on this trip. And we'll see if he comes to the United States, if people can treat him with the respect that he deserves.
We'll end there on this Monday morning, the first day of December. My thanks to our panel, Libby Post, Bo Breslin, and Robert Pendicio. Robert, have a beautiful birthday. Thank you very much.
Thank you, my friend.
Enjoy.
Thanks very much.
We will have more show, a whole hour of it, coming up. Take a break, and we'll be back right after this.